So returning to our agenda, let me make sure we have all the folks. Yeah, we do. Returning to our agenda, we are going to take it up at item six, which is our review of total portfolio performance. And I believe I'm going to turn this over to Mr. Price to tee this up.
Good morning. This is actually, we're going to start with the Verus report. So Mike Kamel from Verus is here to present the quarterly report, and then I'll follow it up with the CIO report after that. So I will turn it over to Mr. Kamel.
Excellent. Mike, the floor is yours.
All right. Well, as is customary, I'll start with some comments around the market and the themes that we're seeing, and then transition into the Contra Costa County portfolio. Am I, Tim, to be sharing materials, or is everyone just following along in the packet?
That's up to you, Mike, but if you'd like to present the quarterly report, you're free to screen share and show the quarterly report there. That might be easier to redirect people to the individual pages.
Okay. Bear with me 1 second then. All right.
There we are.
Is that visible for everyone?
Oh, yes.
Okay. Let me try that. Is that better?
No, it's great. Yeah, the big font. Okay. For people like me, I can read it. Yeah.
Well, it's been a certainly optimistic period for markets, and we've seen very strong performance. I think the focal point of that, or the main theme, is really a reflationary economy. So I want to spend some time digging into, you know, the magnitude of that, what is causing it, what are the risks, and then importantly, of course, is how that, you know, strong growth that we're seeing within markets and the economy coming back online, how that's flowing through into markets. And then we'll dig a little deeper under the hood on a few interesting things, you know, most notably, I think, within equities, but also within interest rates. And then last but not least, I'll share some news on the vaccine front with COVID, although I think that is well covered, and most of us are probably following along with that. And so I won't spend too much time on that. In terms of you know, the economic reopening and the strong growth that we've seen, I'm going to start here on page 11 with GDP growth. Obviously, Q3 2020, if we rewind the clock, was very strong in terms of quarterly annualized growth rates. If you look at the bottom right-hand graph, Q4 of 2020, we finished the year at a 4.3% annualized clip. And then, not pictured here, but released since the end of the quarter, the Q1 estimates are coming in at 6.4%, which is, you know, certainly remarkable on the heels of what's already been a strong recovery. That 6.4% would be the best Q1 GDP print since 1984. So, you know, obviously there's a low base effect that's driving that a little bit, but nonetheless, really remarkable period for growth. First and foremost, what's causing that? It's no secret. You know, the economy is starting to reopen. There's a significant amount of pent up demand, but I think most noteworthy is the amount of stimulus that we're seeing, and both the fiscal and monetary playbooks are in sync right now, and very stimulative to the economy, and that's having a profound effect on growth. A profound effect on stock markets. It's also having some potentially negative side effects in terms of inflation and the labor market that we'll touch on. But starting on the fiscal front, the most noteworthy item is the most recent of the $1.8 trillion American Rescue Plan Act. This was approved in March of this year. This is, of course, following $900 billion that was approved in December. It's following $2.3 trillion from the CARES Act that was approved in March. So it's without a doubt been the most fiscal stimulus we've ever seen. It's dwarfing the amount of stimulus that we saw coming out of the Great Financial Crisis. And what also has made this stimulus so effective is the manner in which it's distributed is quicker than other fiscal stimulus measures that we've had historically. And so the dollars are moving from the government to the consumers quicker. And you know, that's not surprising if you think about those $1,400 a month checks. What's not talked about in this report, but that is, some data that helps contextualize this is the savings rate, which was already very healthy pre-American Rescue Plan Act, hit 27.6% in March, which is the second highest print on record, second only to April of last year. So consumers have more money in their bank accounts than they've ever had. In dollars, that's $6 trillion of personal savings compared to we were at $1 trillion in February of 2020 before this all began. And so you're seeing a lot of that money in consumers' wallets as opposed to just in financial assets or with the banks or elsewhere. And so it's been very direct. The monetary side of the federal government stimulus is consistent, as I mentioned, though probably less accretive to the average consumer and more accretive to financial assets. The most noteworthy, I think, is this notion of flexible average inflation targeting, which is a change in their stance recently in terms of we had really been running below their stated goal of 2% inflation for so long that they widened the goalpost and explained that they're going to be comfortable if they see an inflation print above 2% out of recognition that over a long-term average, they can see a 2% number that is their goal. They are engaged in stimulus in two ways most directly. The first is the $120 billion a month of asset purchases. And the second more conventional monetary policy tool being a 0% interest rate policy, which is of course anchoring the short end of the interest rate curve. The buzzword that you hear really in any financial article or discussion right now is this notion of is inflation transitory? And that's really the $1 million question. Because if it is transitory, which has been the Fed's base case and which is our base case and most market participants' base case, then the Fed can keep this punch bowl on for quite some time and we can continue to have a very robust period of economic growth. If inflation starts to show signs of being more permanent, that will force the Fed to certainly pull back on the $120 billion a month of stimulus or of purchases. That's been known as tapering. And then secondarily, you expect the raise in short-term interest rates to come after that. The Fed is keenly aware that any misstep in their policy will spook markets. And so you're seeing language around, we're going to begin to think about talking about tapering. And so it's not a question of when they'll taper. Well, it's a question of when they'll taper, but how they communicate it in a way that doesn't send markets into their shells is going to be a focal point. It's certainly one of the big risks to this period of economic exuberance coming to an end is the Fed miscommunicating or acting outright too aggressive and switching their policy. But signs are that they're aware of that, and that's a risk that they're able to manage. On 13, we talk a little bit about inflation. The headline print in March was 2.6%. In April, we saw that rise to 4.2%. If you try to look under the hood a little bit on that, and many people are in terms of trying to answer this question of whether this inflation is transitory, there's some aspects of it that would certainly lead you to conclude that it is transitory. A big component of that rise in April was a spike in used car prices. Do we think that used car prices can rise 10%, you know, indefinitely? Probably not. There's, you know, supply shortages right now in the used car market, which is driven by, you know, a lot of things. Basically, there wasn't car auctions because there wasn't, you know, people's loans being foreclosed on. There wasn't, you know, there's not as much supply coming from the rental car market because rental car companies weren't renting cars for the last year. And so they're not turning over their inventory as much. There's a little bit of a chip shortage, which has also led to inventory of new cars being below expectations. So interesting little anomalies that are going on, and some of it is certainly pent up demand. Supply shortages that have been created by the COVID shutdown. But whether or not this inflation proves to be transitory or more permanent, and if it is permanent, how significant, what is the magnitude of it, that is going to inform Fed policy, and the market is going to be in attempting to front run that as much as they can. My hunch is that the big rise in interest rates that we had in Q1 was, you know, already in effect pricing in some of that recognition that the Fed is going to need to cut back because the fiscal stimulus has been so effective. And so we saw 10-year treasuries go from 0.9% at the beginning of the year all the way up to 1.7%. They've settled in a little bit lower than that now, but that's a huge rise in interest rates over a short time period. And, you know, inflation expectations are driving that, expectations of stronger growth, but in, you know, an indirect, you know, next order thing that's being anticipated is the Fed cutting back on their asset purchases or tapering.
Mike, while you're on the Fed, yes. Yesterday's Wall Street Journal noted that the Fed balance sheet is now at almost $8 trillion, with another trillion at least yet to go. Almost all of that might be described as electronic printed money. How can that not be inflationary on a longer-term basis? How can it not be?
Well, they're playing from the same playbook that they utilized coming out of the Great Financial Crisis. It's really the fiscal side that's in some ways using a new playbook, but the Fed is doing the same quantitative easing tools that they used then. And I don't remember the exact magnitude of how large their balance sheet got at the peak of the first several rounds of quantitative easing, but I want to say it was in the neighborhood of where they're at today. And so during that period of time, everyone in the market was scratching their head, wondering, how are we not seeing inflation? How are we not seeing inflation? There's so much money going into the system. And in some ways you could argue you're seeing asset price inflation. I mean, it's inflationary when you see stocks, you know, growing at a rate that's far in excess of their earnings growth for, you know, a decade on end. But, you know, ultimately in terms of the inflation that, you know, we're used to measuring, we weren't seeing that. And it's probably because that there is so much disinflationary or deflationary pressures due to globalization, due to an aging workforce, due to just technology being a deflationary force. And so those Libra scales are constantly going back and forth, and there was enough pressure on on the opposite side of it last time, that it proved not to be overly inflationary. Did that answer your question?
My recollection is it was by magnitudes lower than the current 8 trillion that it got to, effectively the increase in the money supply that eventually got through the tapering process. But it's purely my recollection on it. I'm looking at it. The numbers not too many years ago were under a trillion, the balance sheet. And I'm talking 2, 3, 4 years ago. So the increases have just been staggering. I don't expect an answer, but one of the things it seems to me this takes us to, I have no doubt that Tim has given a lot of thought to it, is how do we hedge if in fact we are in a bubble on asset values because of the Fed producing money, what's going to happen when that bubble disappears? And is there anything we can do, and what should we be doing about it?
So I don't know that I can directly give you a satisfactory answer, but whether or not asset prices are in a bubble really depends on whether the economy can keep growing. Because if, you know, valuations are certainly expensive in equities, credit spreads are very tight, but earnings are very strong, earnings are coming back rapidly. And so companies can justify these valuations if they continue to have earnings growth, like we've seen coming in, you know, in the first few quarters. The other thing I'll say is the Fed, you know, is inflating markets in one way through, you know, their manipulation of the interest rate curve. And that already, you know, sort of adjusted in spite of that. And we saw a much steeper interest rate curve. Now, could it get steeper? Could the short end rise more? Sure. But I think that, you know, the fact that we saw interest rates rise as much as they did in Q1 and didn't see more of a sell-off in equities, we saw some of the growth sectors, you know, enter some correction territory. But by and large, you know, the market was able to shrug off interest rates rising significantly. And so, you know, that provides some semblance of comfort that it's not a bubble. Now, it's very hard to say you're in a bubble beforehand. It becomes very obvious after. And the distinction is, of course, where earnings go. One thing, and the next point I was going to make is on 14, with respect to the labor market. I think this is certainly something that the Fed is pointing to as there's enough slack here that they can keep that punch bowl alive and not risk overheating the economy to too great of an extent. You know, you look at the headline unemployment numbers, we were somewhere around 14 or even I think 20% for a month or so. We're back down to 6% headline unemployment, which is, you know, arguably near full employment. But when you look at under the hood in that measure, it's about 2-3% worse than that if you look at it on a jobs to heartbeat type of measure. And the difference is the labor force participation rate, which went from about 63% to 61%. It's at 61.7 as of April. That, you know, reduces the denominator of the traditional unemployment measure, because if people are not currently looking for work, then they're not counted in that ratio. And so I mentioned earlier on the ancillary side effects of all this stimulus has been that on margin, some workers are disincentivized from going back to work if they can make more in unemployment benefits than they can, working a low paying job, then they're going to take the unemployment benefits. And so, you're seeing states react to that, certainly in terms of some states are rolling back the incremental unemployment benefits to try to combat this, to try to entice people back to work. But we've seen the number of open positions at or near all-time highs. And so there's a significant number of job openings that are not being filled right now. Part of that is obviously structural, but part of that is likely due to the unemployment stimulus measures. We saw a very large miss in the April jobs report. There was 266,000 new jobs versus about 1 million expected. And so whether that's an anomaly or not, or whether these people come back into the workforce once the extra checks expire or run out, that will also be a big part of the story, I think. So shifting more into market impact, I mentioned interest rates, which is on 22. Everything is really priced off of risk-free interest rates in some fashion. And so when there's a big repricing of risk-free rates like we saw this quarter, you expect a lot of volatility. And I think, as I mentioned, kind of given that significant move, it was relatively benign. I don't know if you can see my mouse cursor.
Can.
But the red line was where the yield curve was at to start the year. And this dark blue line that you can't really see the last part of it is where we ended the year. So, that's a pretty significant steepening for one quarter. You can see that relative to history, there's certainly been higher interest rate regimes, but most of those were tied to higher short-term interest rates. And so obviously when the Fed tapers, that will provide insight into when they'll ultimately raise the short end and when the curve might flatten. But there has been periods that have been steeper than this. Most notably, you can see in this graph on 12/31/2010. That story, was impactful in terms of how markets performed within equities. And so first and foremost, financials did very well because financials, banks in particular, require an upward sloping yield curve, or it helps them in terms of generating profits. You saw credit spreads very tight, as you can see here on the bottom right. In many markets, we're at all-time tight spreads relative to history. So you're not getting a lot of incremental yield for taking credit risk. At the same time, the yields that you are getting on treasuries are not sufficient to satisfy liabilities. And so it's forcing asset allocators like yourselves into challenging discussions. On the equity environment, starting on 28, the U.S. was the best market for the quarter, up 6.2 for large cap. We saw small cap outperform significantly, up 12.7%. We also saw value significantly outperform growth. You can see on the 1 year, the small caps have really shot it out of the park, 94.8%. Obviously, there's an endpoint bias issue here when you're looking at the trailing one-year numbers, because that starts April 1st, and most of the sell-off in markets occurred in the first quarter of 2020. So you have that bad period rolling off, and then you're left with the very strong returns off the bottom. But the noteworthy thing, I think, is over the last quarter, you've seen value outperform growth by 10.2%. Even in spite of that, because growth did so well during the pandemic, growth is still ahead on a 1 year. You can see 62% versus 56.1%. So this value resurgence, there's more catch up to be had if we continue to see the momentum within value. You've probably talked about this in prior meetings, but it's, the value sectors are more aligned with economic reopening. They're more cyclical. You have financials doing very well, as I mentioned, due to higher interest rates and more lending activity. You have energy prices, rising significantly. Obviously, that's, you could have a 30-minute discussion just on that, but energy is a big component of the value universe. And you can see that on 29 here.
Mike, in the interest of time, let's maybe wrap up the the bigger picture items, because I know we want to get into the individual investment allocation.
Yeah, sure. I can really stop there in the interest of time. I had some COVID data to share, but it's nothing that you guys can't read in a newspaper. So any questions on the economic update?
Don't see any. Go right ahead.
All right. So jumping into performance for the quarter ending March 31st, you can see in a dollar value basis, we were up $286.2 million to end the quarter at $10.356 billion of assets. You can see the longer term asset growth and asset allocation history there. You can see the allocations relative to both our long-term and current targets. Those current targets are 68.5% for the growth, 25% to liquidity, and 6.5% to diversifying. We're working towards those targets. I believe we'll be trimming back some of the growth portfolio specifically, I know in the risk parity, to bring those targets down. Looking at performance for the quarter and out longer term on an absolute basis, certainly strong. You can see 24.1% for that 1 year ending March 31st, 7.8 for a 3 year average, 8.6 for a 5 year average, and an even 8 over 10 years. When you look at the long-term performance relative to the policy index, there is some underperformance there. It's 100 basis points of underperformance over 1 year, 110 over three, and 80 over five. The story there with the longer term underperformance is twofold. It's domestic equity underperformance with your managers in terms of some headwinds for active management that I'll get into. And then the second component, which you've certainly addressed, is within private markets and how you benchmark private markets. And so you'll recall the shift was made to neutralize the performance of that, given it's kind of artificial tracking error. But however, that's made on a prospective basis, and we're not going back and changing your policy index for that.
Right.
A little bit of underperformance from the diversifying bucket. Sorry, was there a question?
Nope.
A little bit of underperformance from the diversifying bucket, but that's a small component of it. For the quarter specifically, we saw 40 basis points of underperformance, so 2.8% versus 3.2%. We saw a little bit of underperformance within risk parity, which underperformed given the more significant exposure to interest rates, which wasn't enough to offset the strong performance from commodities and equities. And then you had a little bit of underperformance within your global equity portfolio. You can see that attribution quantitatively on page 6, which I won't go too much into detail, but as I mentioned, global equity and risk parity were laggards.
So do you, just in the context of Verus advising us, do you have any concern about the underperformance? Is there anything we ought to know or you think we should be thinking about?
No, I'm comfortable at this point with all of the sources of underperformance. Scott and I spent a lot of time going through the portfolio in preparation for this and kind of re-examining where we stand with some of these issues. And in general, the sources of underperformance, especially within your equities, they're understandable in light of the active management environment that we've been seeing. There's a couple managers, Ceridex in particular, where their rope may not be as long as it once was, and we're maybe closer to wanting to recommend a change than we were several quarters ago, but nothing terribly pressing at all. And that might be a good segue. I'm going to jump to the net of fees performance. So within the growth portfolio, you can see domestic equity, 11% of the overall portfolio, up 6.6% for the quarter, outperforming the benchmark for the quarter, outperforming over 1 year. So in aggregate, your managers are performing well over the most recent time period. The two outliers for the quarter in terms of underperformance, Jackson Square, down 2.6 compared to 0.9 for their benchmark. So 350 basis points of underperformance. You can attribute that to the growth headwinds that I mentioned in terms of especially IT. A lot of those information technology stocks that had been leading the way, people took their gains and rotated into value with them. They gave back some of their 2020 outperformance of about 6%.
Any way you can go to a full screen on the exhibit?
Yes, apologies. Is that better?
No, that's not good.
There we go.
There we go. That's better. Thank you.
Okay. Sure. So I mentioned Jackson Square. In general, performing how we would expect in this environment, given their growth focus, it's a concentrated portfolio. The Boston Partners, performing on the positive side, up 4.7 versus their benchmark. Their value orientation certainly explains a lot of that, even relative to the benchmark. They were overweight energy, overweight financials, which I mentioned did very well. Ceridex, I mentioned, is probably one where we have a little bit more concern than the rest, given, they've had a quality value focus. You would have expected, a little bit better performance in 2020, more so than in the first quarter of 2021.
Mike, I think we lost you there. Or maybe it was me.
Yeah, no, my computer shorted out for a minute there. Can you guys hear me?
Yep, I can hear you now. And we've got.
So I was talking about Ceridex. Given the value outperformance for the quarter, they were up 14.4, but trailed their benchmark by 6.8. They define this as more of a lower quality rally and not an environment they expect to do well.
Mike, you're having some technical. I don't even see him on my screen now.
I don't know why. Can you guys hear me again?
Can hear you now.
I don't know why my internet's a little finicky. I apologize.
It must have been me requesting a full exhibit.
I'll try to
talk fast. Yeah.
Let me mute or turn off my camera to maybe that'll help the bandwidth. Anyway, the Ceridex story, I went back and looked at it, over the trailing 5-year period, you can see they're down 3.7% a year, but But if you rewind the clock and look at that 5 year as of last year at this time, they were significantly better than the benchmark by 1.3% a year. So, you know, it's a little bit of the cycle of active management that's just not working in our favor with them at this point. But, you know, some concern when you see 3 and 5 year numbers like that. Pereford was a big laggard for the quarter on the international equity side, but their long-term performance remains very strong, so no concerns there. You can see 5.8 over 3 years versus 2.4 for the benchmark.
Can I ask a question, Mike?
Yes.
Just a quick question, if I could, either for Tim or for Mike. Are we staying on top of this with Ceradex? I assume they understand they're going to get a call, or they've already received a call. How actively are we letting them know we're watching what's going on?
Yeah, I can comment on that. We concur that this is becoming a more significant issue. Apologies for the camera angle. It's becoming a more significant issue. We have been in contact with Ceradex. You know, that level of underperformance in a single quarter, you know, while we don't want to overstate a single quarter, it's materially impacting the longer term record. They did have quite a bit of a snapback in April, not enough to cover that deficit, but we've had two calls with them, and we expect to have a more deep on-site with them kind of coming up into the June period when we see the second quarter come together a little bit more here. So it's certainly an area of active dialogue, and we concur that this is something we need to take a closer look at.
Thank you.
All right, Mike, continue.
All right. Emerging markets was a very strong quarter for active management for both our more growth-oriented and value-oriented managers. You can see the PIMCO Research Affiliates fundamental index approach is you know, meant to capture more pure value, and that worked very well in the quarter, up 11.5 compared to 4.1, and that trend is reflected in the 1 year now, and that brought the 3 year up as well. Artisan on the global equity front had a challenging quarter. This is that growth narrative that I talked about in terms of a lot of the market leaders that they've benefited from over the longer term, hurt them over the most recent period. No significant concerns there. First Eagle, significant laggard for the quarter, down 4.6 versus the benchmark. Down about 10 over the 1 year period. But the longer term performance is certainly better. They have a pretty unique approach to global equity. They're very benchmark agnostic. They'll hold gold, they'll hold gold related equities. And that uniqueness didn't help them in the quarter. On the fixed income side, high yields was a laggard for the quarter. Allianz was down 1.4 for their benchmark. This was really a function of them not owning the lower quality energy high yield securities that rallied. But we don't have any concerns. High yield is a weird market for benchmarking, given the very, very low quality stuff is not defaulted and done very well. And, you know, it's not the type of securities you really expect an active manager to own. There's a little bit of a kind of a weird formatting issue here. So apologies. There, it's total private real estate is the 5.9% of the portfolio allocation that was up 3.5%. And then there's the private equity line item at 10.6%. That portfolio was up 10.7 for the quarter, 17.7 for the 1 year, 13.4 for the 3 year. And then the risk parity, it's 4.8% of the portfolio, but it's going to 3%. Risk parity managers they do as a function of, what you're buying when you sign up for risk parity, they hold leveraged exposure to interest rates. And so in a period where you have interest rates rally to the extent they did, that's going to be a very challenging environment for any risk parity strategy. But long term, it's still been an effective strategy. The commodities component of both of these strategies helps them out significantly during the quarter, given those rising inflation expectations and a lot of supply constraints. You saw commodities do very well. Within the diversifying bucket, this is a certainly small part of the portfolio at 5% in aggregate. You know, most of this portfolio is predicated on interest rates. And when interest rates rise, you expect to see negative returns, as we did, most notably from the AFL-CIO strategy. But longer term and over the most recent period, that strategy has served well relative to its benchmark due to the structural yield advantage associated with the securities they hold, as well as the shorter duration, which helps protect capital in a rising rate environment. The parametric defensive equity strategy is predicated on implied volatilities changing, and that strategy did very well for the quarter of 3.7%. And over the 1 year, you can see up 8.2%, but some ground to make up relative to inception to date performance of negative 2.1. The Acadian multi-asset is a newer strategy that was added to the diversifying bucket. It was about flat for the quarter. It's up 1.4% annualized since August of last year. Not too much going on in the liquidity bucket. It's a big chunk of the portfolio at about 19%. It was about flat for the quarter. This is a period of time when you're thankful that we didn't try to take on more duration risk within our liquidity bucket to try to reach for yield. Because, with that reach for more interest rate exposure, more risk, you would have seen significantly more negative returns over this time period. Last page I'll cover, as I always like to cover, is all the way on 28, which is the Sharpe ratios.
Can I ask you a quick question?
Sure.
Yeah, question.
So on the executive summary, the 10-year, we have a 8% return versus 8.7 on the benchmark. And so the concern there is, are we not capturing the upside as much as we would hope? But are you saying that the part of that is because the benchmarks themselves are imperfect and hard to gauge yourself by?
Yes. So the benchmark mismatch, especially in private markets, is a big component of that 70 basis points of underperformance. I don't think that it's all of it. So there is some what I call true underperformance coming from some of our active managers. And that's a function of the challenging environment that it's been over the last 10 years for many active managers. I think you've taken action to address the benchmark mismatch. You're certainly monitoring your managers as effectively as is possible. But there is a way to mitigate that going forward even more, and that's to increase the degree of passive management that you utilize. And that's always an ongoing discussion, is because that's always the trade-off, is you're trading certain fees for uncertain alpha, and in this case, some negative alpha. But by and large, I'd say the majority of your managers have performed fairly well.
Okay, thank you.
On 28, I was just going to point to the Sharpe ratios, which are, what we don't want to focus just on performance in a vacuum, but we want to focus on performance relative to the amount of risk that we're taking, because that risk that we're taking is really the bogey in terms of, are we getting compensated for taking that amount of risk? And in fact, the story consistently here is that we're doing very well on a risk adjusted basis. 0.9 for the 3 year, which is 28th percentile, 1.2 for the 5 year, which is 24th percentile, and 1 for the 10 year, which is 27th percentile. So right around top quartile overall time period.
So
Mike, just one question.
Go ahead.
Sorry, I think the Sharpe ratio performance of the total fund over time looks great, but I was just wondering, for the 1 year time period, why is the policy so low?
So you're saying the 1 year of 3.4 being in the 92nd percentile?
Yeah.
That does seem odd. I don't know offhand the answer to that. So your policy index return over the 1 year is 25.1, which is low. So what it's got to be is the risk of the policy was higher than peers over the 1 year. But that wouldn't really make sense. Tim, do you happen to have an idea on that? I don't know, and I don't want to misspeak.
I would say let's go ahead and follow up on that. You know,
yeah.
My sense is the risk of the policy index, was running well above the experience risk of our actual portfolio. But rather than speculate here, let's get the numbers and come back to you. That's a good question, Jay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wouldn't this also just be tied back to March 31st of 2020 for the 1 year period, which was right at the dip?
It certainly is part of it. The fact that there's a lot of volatility embedded in some of the, and again, I don't mean to harp on this public market benchmarking issue for private markets, but because, Verus started the change to that benchmarking on, basically January 1st, you have 3/4 of the legacy benchmarking in there, 1/4 of the new benchmarking in there, you're going to see a lot of the volatility of those public markets reflected in the policy benchmark over that period. We just didn't experience that level of volatility in those actual private market segments. So I'm going to guess that's part of it. But again, let's go back and decompose it rather than, speculate on the fly here.
Agreed.
Any other questions I can help with?
Any other questions of Mike?
Could you take a couple of minutes to discuss commercial real estate? It seems to be all over the board at this point, especially in the wake of COVID and virtual meetings. I mean, you hear about people saying they're all coming back. Other people are saying, nope, we're never coming back. What does that seem to be doing globally to commercial real estate markets? Not globally, talking about United States growth.
Yeah, I'm checking if we have a slide on this.
When the forecasts seem to be that diametrically opposed, it suggests to me that nobody knows for sure.
You're certainly seeing a period of rapid restructuring. You're seeing very high vacancy rates in office, which is a new phenomenon. The structures undergoing the retail sector that's existed well prior to COVID. And that's what I characterize as kind of the Amazon effect. And you've got a ton of real estate in institutional portfolios of malls, and whether it be conventional shopping malls or just, brick and mortar, smaller sort of strip malls. A lot of that has to get repurposed, and it's going to take a significant amount of time. It's, both a risk and an opportunity. I think most of the savvy institutional real estate managers, are aware of that. There's certainly a lot of legacy holdings of large malls within some of the very large real estate funds, certainly in core. We're seeing more opportunities in some niche sectors within the real estate market that we think have more demographic tailwinds, more structural tailwinds, things like student housing, senior housing, life sciences and medical office, self-storage, things that we think are more resilient in a post-COVID world.
I mean, and more in see-through buildings for commercial real estate. you've got literally law firms now that have not even returned any of their people back, right. anecdotally in New York. Nobody has returned. And they don't have any prospects of coming back. So I'm wondering what it's going to do to see-through buildings, increase them or decrease them?
It's changing, you know, consumption habits. I, for one, you know, I relocated out of LA and I moved to the Phoenix area because I could work remote and be just as effective without having to go into an office every day. And so you're seeing that phenomenon everywhere. I think that's a huge story behind the boom in residential real estate. And you've seen residential real estate up 10%. There's more desire for single family housing relative to multifamily housing. There's less desire to be in urban areas. I don't think that, traditional commercial office space is going away. I think that there's just going to be a little bit less demand within those major urban districts.
So Jerry, don't write the check to the real estate REIT that's doing office buildings yet.
Yeah, I think we just got another definite maybe. So I'll just file that away with.
Yeah.
That's as good as the rest of the stuff I've heard. But it's changing.
It's changing, yes. All right, any other questions for Mike?
Yes.
All right. I don't see any further. Mike, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for the report. And I think with that, we will move on to our presentation from Tim, which is, I guess, 6C, right? Well, no, 6B.
Yes, let me go to full screen here and let me know if that's coming through clear.
Yes.
Perfect. Okay, this is the typical complimentary report that we provide every quarter. So Verus is tasked with providing an overall assessment of how managers are performing relative to benchmarks and that sort of thing. This is the attempt to step back and say, you know, big picture, are we still on the right track from our functional basis? And, you know, given that we tend to view some of the asset classes as somewhat interchangeable functionally, is everything working as expected? Is growth delivering capital appreciation? Is liquidity meeting our short-term needs? And is diversifying providing a liquid offset? And so we'll step through this. Let's go to page 3, and that kind of gives our functional report card there. Start with liquidity at the top. So, you know, this is our historically our 4 years of liquidity, moving to 3 years of liquidity over the second and third quarters of this year. Quality is at expectation. Duration is well within the bounds, and it's meeting the number of months of benefit payments perfectly there. As we transition to 3 years of benefit payments in the liquidity portfolio, we are going to see that duration number tick down slightly. So over the next two quarters, you'll see that number declining a bit there. I wouldn't expect it to be dramatic. I mean, we're already at 1.7, but we might tick down another couple tenths of a year there. Growth is our, you know, the bulk of the portfolio does the heavy lifting for us. So we look at this from an absolute return perspective. You know, are we getting, strong returns there? Over the trailing five-year period, we're getting 10.8%. So from an absolute return expectation, it's being met. But of course, we don't invest in a vacuum. We want to say, you know, relative to what we could have done very, very simply, and hindsight's always 20/20, but relative to the global equity benchmark, you know, are we at that? And no, we're lagging that. And I'm going to get into that a little bit more detail when we do a bit deeper dive in the growth portfolio. But the shorter answer is the public market versus private market performance mismatch, not a benchmarking mismatch, performance mismatch is driving a big chunk of that there. But we also look at efficiency, as Mike pointed out on the Sharpe ratios there. And within the growth portfolio, we're still getting an efficient deployment. So we're still coming through with lower volatility than that global equity benchmark. Some of that's going to be due to the accounting of private markets, but you know, this is the best number we can come up with here. And we are meeting expectations within that portfolio. Risk diversifying has been our restructuring portfolio. You know, we added the Acadian strategy last year. We did fund the SIT strategy that the board approved earlier this year. We added that at the beginning of the second quarter. So you'll see that show up in next quarter's report. But we look at this to be an offset. At 0.7% correlation to the growth portfolio, it's a bit higher than we would like to see. We would like that number to be, you know, 0.5 or lower. Part of that is, you know, just due to a market that had a lot of trending forces, both in the first quarter of 2020 and in the recovery that we've seen in the years since then. We do look for positive real returns, so net of inflation numbers over 5 years. And this is something where we're digging out a bit of a hole here. So our trailing five-year real return is negative 0.7%. It's on an improving trend, but we fully recognize that that's not satisfactory. We're obviously hopeful that the new additions and the changes that we've made to the program will put us on a better course going forward. But because it is a trailing five-year number, that's going to take a little while to manifest on this page here.
Having said that, Tim, it looks to me as if Acadian's off to kind of a weak start.
They're off to a fairly flat start. Yeah.
All right, a flat start. So I guess we're going to be keeping a close eye on them since we just made that commitment, and we want to see where it's going to go.
Yeah, I mean, we're two full quarters into that one, and we've got a positive return on it, but a modestly positive return. I'm again, you know, two quarters, it's not a whole lot of information there, but we are in conversation with them to say, you know, hey, what's meeting expectation and what's deviating from expectation here? And the short answer is not a whole lot yet. We watch that rotation to value that really started in the end of 2020 and showed up a lot, in this quarter. I think the rate movement on sovereign debt has been a big part of that story. But, you know, again, it's an ongoing conversation there. But the last point on risk diversifying is it is liquid. It can be redeployed as we did with some of that money, you know, in the April and May timeframe of 2020. So you put everything together and liquidity meeting expectations, growth overall meeting expectations, but you know, we want to see that the private markets, you know, do their heavy lifting and keep up with the public markets over time. We had an extraordinary public market response over the past year, and some of that is, over the past year, it's due to the low valuations that we started the second quarter of 2020 with. But over the 5 year, we've still had an incredibly strong public market environment there. The risk diversifying, as I mentioned, still going through a restructuring there. Unfortunately, that below expectations number is probably going to stick around for a couple of quarters just until we start to see Acadian and SIT have an impact on the portfolio. Hopefully that's a positive impact to Jerry's comment there, but we don't know that yet. And, put it all together, and I'd say we're largely meeting expectations, but we recognize that, you know, we're not hitting on all cylinders at the moment. So let's get into each underlying portfolio and talk a little bit about what's going on. If I move to page 4, here we have the liquidity sub-portfolio where everything is largely working as expected. You have three firms in here, all of which are stable from a firm perspective, getting some good, strong growth, largely seeing growth in the assets, in the product assets as well. Inside a small pullback, we don't view that as significant. And as I said, we expect those duration numbers to start to tick down over the next two quarters as we shrink the size of the overall portfolio. But no changes with the managers, everything working largely as expected. If we turn to the growth portfolio on slide five, I just want to highlight a few things here. With Jackson Square, you see a 20% reduction in the product assets over the past year. This is due to Vanguard pulling Jackson Square out as a sub-advisor for one of their mutual funds. I believe they replaced them with an affiliate there. You see the PIMCO strategy showing a negative return. I think that's largely due to some frustration with the value strategy underperforming at the beginning of this period, although it snapped back. And Adelante showing some shrinkage in the REIT portfolio as well. With AQR, you see a slight reduction in firm assets. You might think that's surprising given the strong response of the public markets over the past year. AQR really struggled as a firm with their quantitative strategies in 2018, 2019. I think you're seeing some of the frustration in 2020 with clients pulling some of the money there. Again, they have snapped back as well end of 2020 and into this year. If we take a look at performance within the growth portfolio, quite a bit of green. And so we're looking at absolute returns here. And, you know, having 60 and 80 and 30% returns is really wonderful over 1 year, but that is coming off the low point of the market sell-off related to COVID-19 in the early part of 2020. We're starting to see a normalization between value and growth strategies, where growth strategies had been outperforming sharply over the past year. If you take a look at just those top two lines there, you know, whereas Jackson Square had been massively outperforming Boston Partners over the 2020 time period, you start to see more of a normalization there over the short-term period. Value still has a ways to go to catch up over the past 5 and 10 years. Some of you will recall that we had Rob Arnott in to present to the board last summer, and he talked about the how far out of favor value was and how historically, you know, when it gets that out of favor, they've never not seen a sharp snapback. I think, history doesn't tell us everything. We are starting to see that pattern play out again. It's got a ways to go yet, though. And, John, you had raised the question about how we're thinking about inflation. I think some of this is kind of where we position within these markets. We can't understate the fact or the role that the Federal Reserve has had in supporting markets, both coming out of the 2008-2009 time period and now with the low rates and the asset purchases. It's really helped assets that have most of their expectations for returns farther in the future. So those farther out returns have a higher valuation. You're not discounting them as much. I think if we start to see a rising rate environment, we're going to see some of the value strategies that have durable current cash flow start to become more valuable. Now, whether that's they go up in value relative to growth, or growth comes down in value or comes down in price relative to value strategies, that directionality, I can't say. But if we take a look at this and say, equities over long periods of time tend to do well in inflationary environments. And then you start to look into what part of the equity market would we want to be biased towards. We're going to start to bias towards the current cash flow. So folks who have dividend income, stable recurring cash flow. And that would be the rotation that we'd be eyeing within the equity segment. I think the other things that we tend to look at that are historically have done well in inflationary environments would be commodities, which we have relatively little exposure to today. TIPS, which we have relatively little exposure to today. And then of course, real estate, which is, I'm not going to answer Jerry Holcomb's question about where it's going. I think we have more questions than answers there. But certainly if we start to see a normalization of the U.S. economy, the entire market segment is priced down when other things have gone up. It's got room for prices to come up. It needs the support of fundamentals and rental income, but it has room to come up there. But the big story on here, if we take a look at the bottom of this table, is you take a look at the private equity, private credit, and real estate, the premiums versus MSCI ACWI. So this is, are you outperforming or underperforming a global equity benchmark? And, you know, 37% underperformance for private equity, 51% underperformance for private credit, and 56% underperformance for real estate are remarkable numbers. This is a time period where the MSCI ACWI was up 54%. And so you have real estate, which traded down slightly. So you have a huge gap there. Now, private equity was still up, you know, 17.5%, I think, you know, in absolute terms, a good return. But the private markets aren't going to benefit as much from the Federal Reserve moving those rates dramatically. I think, you know, the fundamentals certainly haven't improved as much as the valuations have. And the valuations have been directly impacted by the Federal Reserve's low interest rate environment. That's simply not as germane to the quarter-to-quarter valuation in the private markets. We're holding something for operational cash flow or within venture capital, you know, kind of value creation. And you're just not getting as much of that snapback in a short time period here. And unfortunately, that deviation was so significant over the one-year period that has drawn down the five-year premium numbers there. So private markets not meeting expectation relative to public markets over the past 5 years. There's not a reason we see that that should persist. The fundamentals within the private equity portfolio still look solid and improving. Within private credit, I will say it has weathered the storm better than expected, better than our expectations going in. Real estate, you know, is where we're spending a lot of time right now. So real estate came through in a rocky manner. So we haven't seen the defaults tick up yet, but we've certainly seen impacted rent collections, delayed projects, that sort of thing. I would say within the past 6 weeks or so, we're starting to see some green shoots within that segment in terms of transactions happening, projects reaccelerating, hotels reopening, rent collection and multifamily increasing. And, you know, I think we're the next data point is really going to come in September and October when we see what the office utilization is after the summertime period here. I think, you know, so much of the return to work is predicated on, at this point forward, it's really a lot of men have returned to work and a lot of women have not returned to work. And that's somewhat predicated on the childcare availability and the role of public schools in providing some of that aspect. So if the schools are starting to reopen in the fall, we can start to see more availability of labor from women. Hopefully we start to see women, you know, re-entering the workforce. And those are largely, you know, more heavily biased towards the hospitality industry, which again is just barely starting to come back now. So I want to acknowledge the underperformance, but I want to put it in context of there's a couple moving parts that aren't yet manifested in these private market pieces.
Tim, can I ask you a question?
Absolutely.
So on the equities, we have return, and in the private markets, you have premium.
Right.
So return means real return.
Absolute return, yeah.
Investment. And then premium means what it looks like compared to a benchmark. Is that correct?
What it looks like compared to the global equity benchmark, yeah.
Global equity benchmark, okay. So we don't have figures on return yet for private equity.
No, we do. So your private equity return over the 1 year was about 17.5%. Private credit was single digits and real estate was slightly negative over that time period.
Okay. And when we're talking about real estate, private equity investments incorporate a lot of real estate investment into it, right? So when you say private equity versus real estate, Are you talking about direct investment in the real estate outside of a private equity arrangement?
The real estate here would be all of our private limited partnerships for real estate managers. So this would be the Invesco Strategies, DLJ, LaSalle, Long Wharf. Within private equity, this is, you know, obviously our legacy fund of funds exposure, where we're buying, you know, we're buying into funds that are buying stakes in individual companies, plus the transition to the direct deals that we've done over the past 3 years here. So while there might be some real estate embedded in those private equity numbers, we're really taking private stakes in, or, you know, private stakes in private companies there. The real estate would be secondary or tertiary to, you know, the business strategies there. So the real estate is pure real estate in a private equity wrapper.
Okay. And one thing that we've been dealing with over the years is increased competition in with respect to private equity investment and private credit investment as people were chasing yield. And since the market has done so well relative to private equity at this time, do you see overall competition for those investments to be waning a little bit? And does that open an opportunity for us to be more selective on higher quality private equity investments?
It's a great question, because of all the billions of dollars that have been raised by private equity really over the past decade, and a lot of it had not been invested. So, you know, there's still a lot of committed but uninvested capital from private equity funds. We're not seeing the competitive landscape change materially right now within private equity. And now part of that is we have transitioned from fund to funds to trying to get the best in class. Well, best in class is always going to have a lot of demand. But overall, I think that wall of dry powder for private equity kind of gives 3 or 4 years of you know, baked in competitiveness until we start to see things change there. Within private credit, you know, I think one of the things that we did prudently there was say, we didn't want to go in on market terms. We went into a separate account where we could dictate credit quality and underwriting terms there. And, you know, I think we got a little bit lower deal flow because we're going higher quality. That hasn't changed a whole lot yet. But again, through the reopening process over the summer, we expect that we're going to get some directional change there and some more information. And then real estate, you know, real estate is a cyclical business. It's thankfully it's not boom and bust, but it is quite cyclical. So, you know, we tend to migrate within the real estate universe to where we see attractive valuations. So right now, you know, obviously we had hotels that were closed for 6, 9, 12 months that are reopening. You know, the valuations are down on that because the cash flows are down on that. So now we have to see how they come back. Office buildings are a bit of a wild card, but those are typically 10-year leases. And so, you know, we're going to see that kind of filter through over the next, couple of years here. I think in terms of the development pipeline for real estate is obviously much smaller than it was 12 or 18 months ago. The competitiveness of raising capital in that space, I don't know yet because the market hasn't really restarted yet, but we're watching it. And if no other questions on the growth portfolio, I will turn us to page 9 for risk diversifying. Couple things to highlight here. With the parametric, you see a negative 30% product asset growth over the past year. This is a very narrowly defined product, and we're one of only a few clients, and we took a redemption, so that we drove that number via a partial redemption last year. The other thing I would highlight is we'd previously announced that Parametric's parent company, Eaton Vance, was being acquired by Morgan Stanley, and that the portfolio manager was going to retire as part of that process. Jay Strohmeyer has retired now. Alex Faber is in that role today. We've had good conversations with Alex. And, you know, I think we continue to think about where Parametric best fits, but we're comfortable with the organizational shift to Alex there. And the other thing I'd mention again, you're going to see SIT show up here next quarter as that gets funded in April and gets up and running here. And then just to wrap it up on 11, big picture versus that simple target index, you know, we do see the underperformance of the Cicero portfolio versus the simple investable public market benchmark. Again, partially due to the private market underperformance relative to the public markets. Our volatility is running, you know, about two-thirds to even less of that simple target index. So on a risk-adjusted basis, again, we still see a superior risk-adjusted return. Now, I will say that this references the old asset allocation. The new asset allocation is going to start showing up here in the second quarter. That does increase the overall risk budget of the portfolio. So you're starting to see, I would expect to see our volatility numbers tick up slightly relative to the benchmark. And hopefully we can maintain the Sharpe ratios there.
Tim, I had a question. If you could go back just to page 10, I just want to make an observation. I never thought when we started keeping track of these things that we would ever see a day when the two lines might cross. And it looks to me as if we're about to participate in an equal number of upside captures and downside captures, but they were had a good spread between them for years. And now it looks like they're just about to cross. It's just an interesting picture.
It is an interesting picture. And certainly if they cross, that's not what we want to see there. I think we might want to add something to this that talks about kind of the degree of upside versus the degree of downside, because this tells a story that's informative, but it also can be a little bit misleading. Whereas, you know, if you have a period where the benchmark is down 1% and you're down 1.5%, it's a huge capture ratio. It's a relatively modest difference. And we've had more up markets than down markets over this time period here. So we might add something to this page that contextualizes that a bit more, just to talk about the absolute measure of capture as well. But I agree, we want to maintain the spread. We certainly hope the spread returns over the next couple of quarters here. But I think we might add some detail there that tells a more fulsome story.
Thank you.
And that concludes my prepared comments. Happy to take any trustee questions.
Any other questions for Tim? Look, and I don't have my full view back, but I don't think there are any further questions. So if none, thank you, Tim.
Great, thank you.
All right, moving right along. I believe we've covered item 7. So, John, I think we are going to ask for a report out from the audit committee from its May 5